This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Well, it's Wednesday, the 26th of February. Can you believe almost 2 months of the year have passed us by? This news cycle just keeps getting stronger and stronger. Our top story today, we're going to go straight into it. Private Secretary of Jacob Zuma, Isaac Lishona, has said that things are not good in the MK party and that he predicts there could be a split in that party in the near future. Seems as though the introduction of the new Secretary General, Floyd Shivambu from the EFF, hasn't exactly worked out the way that was anticipated. Now, this is quite important because in the recent by-election in KZN, the MK party fell precipitously from its vote in that area in the national election. And in the latest poll from the Social Research Foundation, MK party actually went down from around 14%. To 12%. But let's listen in. He spoke, did Mr. Lishona, to my colleague Chris Stain.
Well, you have, or you were definitely in a position on the inside to tell us what the real problems at MKP are.
Yes. MKP, from inception, experienced divisions, which would happen for any party. There are teething problems that would happen to any party. And we managed these problems up until the elections. Hence, we pulled the historic 15%. However, after the elections, a few months after the elections, the current SG, Floyd Shivambu, was brought in. And this exacerbated MKP problems. I personally flagged the appointment because I knew what it could cause to the structures and the stability of MK party. When Mr. Floyd Shivambu came in, he never bothered to consult with people who were in his office, the former SG, former DSGs. He never bothered to consult with me at the office of the president, although we were the ones who were aware of the situation on the ground. And Mr. Floyd Shivambu's coming in also meant that there were also people coming in from the EFF, and he promoted them over and above people who'd been working at the ground in provinces as well as in regions. So this has caused a lot of animosity. And now there's a real risk for the party to break away. There's a real possibility that there'll be a breakaway party soon from the MK party. I speak this with authority because I'm privy of a lot of information, and many, many comrades still confide in me, in this regard. So the indictment also, as you mentioned earlier, is that there are polls, but over and above the polls, the elections results to show that MKP is losing ground. We see in Mhlabuyalingana, where MKP had 54% at the time of the national elections. Now it came back with a mere 19%. This is an indictment to the CEO of the party, who in this instance happens to be the Secretary General, who happens to be Comrade Floyd Shivambu. He has to account for how the party can come from those numbers to a mere 19%. But over and above that, this tendency of MKP of recycling the leadership from municipalities to national and parliament, recycling ANC members, recycling EFF members, while we have an opportunity to bring about fresh leadership who would inject fresh ideas, causes communities and the nation at large to lose confidence because they voted in for a new baby and not for an ANC or an EFF 2.0. So if these things are not taken into consideration, we are really at the brink of catastrophe as the MKP party.
Well, some pretty interesting stuff there. And this political world that we live in South Africa, it gets more and more complicated, doesn't it? Well, something that got social media buzzing this morning was the reposting of an article that was published on the front page, well, dominated the whole front page of the Daily Dispatch, a local newspaper in East London. And the article spoke about land grabbers' move onto East London Farm. Those who only read the headline would have felt that, are we heading the way of Zimbabwe? Certainly those who've been criticizing the expropriation without compensation legislation that Cyril Ramaphosa signed into law will be using this as well as supporting their argument. Bruce Page, the owner of the Claremont Farm, is quoted as saying that he has things under control. So we got hold of Peter Klutter, who's the chairman of Agri Eastern Cape, to find out his insights on this land invasion where Bruce Page's farm has now got more than 700 plots that have been staked out by, well, essentially squatters. Let's listen in.
So, yeah, Alec, look, it is what we see. They have moved on to the land. I have not spoken to the Pages myself, but our CEO has. And the Pages assure us that they are in talks with government. That land is unfarmable. It's right next to Umdansani, which is the main township of East London. Cannot be farmed anymore. And they have been talking to the government for numerous years to have it rezoned for housing. And of course, like everything else, government's dragging its feet.
Peter, what's the best case scenario here?
Best case scenario, government pays the man out at market value and they develop it, put the infrastructure in and give people housing. That's what are our biggest problems in this country? It's unemployment and lack of housing. They're probably some of our two biggest problems. And because of that, it just leads on to all sorts of other things. So to me, government should settle this ASAP and put the whole story to bed, because if it doesn't, it's going to come back and bite them. With the whole expropriation bill that's been signed into law and everything that's gone on in America, this is the last and the least thing that they can actually afford to have on their plate at the moment.
And as far as your members of Agrius SA in the Eastern Cape are concerned, are you getting panicked phone calls, or is everyone pretty calm about it?
But this London case, it's been pretty quiet. Obviously, that there's going to be a meeting with the local farmers down there that live in the area. They have called for a meeting in the next few days. Generally, in the province, I think everybody understands this whole expropriation thing. Look, there's politics and politics, Alec, as you know. And we have got to just try and read between the lines and not be sucked into all the social media. It is a major concern. We do not accept the expropriation bill in its current form. I think it's dangerous. And I've said it in a newsletter to my members. At the moment, I think it is a political fight. It's for the GNU and the politicians to sort it out. The minute it lands on our table as agriculturalists, it certainly becomes a farming problem. And this may well be the test case. Who knows? I think the sooner I get onto our premier and see what his stance on this is going to be, the better.
If you recall, one of the things that the ANC fought hard for in the EWC Act that they got through was to bring in a clause which says for nil compensation. Now, not everybody's getting nil compensation. Perhaps Mr. Page might be facing that possibility. The reports that we get back from East London and from that farm is that there are politicians and fancy cars and politicians, local politicians, who've been selling off stands on the Page farm for between 15 and 25,000 rand. Curiouser and curiouser, but that's really nothing compared with what's going on internationally. In the past week, South Africa found itself suddenly bereft of its staunchest ally over decades. Well, I say South Africa, but it's more likely the African National Congress. The ANC instructed its man at the United Nations to vote against a resolution that was introduced by the United States supporting Russia on its invasion into Ukraine. And which way did South Africa vote? for Ukraine. Well, that's a turn up for the books. The first time ever that it's gone against Russia. Things really have changed in a big way. Everyone's confused. But one of the least confused people is Professor Irina Filatova. She was born and bred and educated in Moscow, and I caught up with her earlier today. The full interview, which is fascinating, is on BizNews TV on YouTube, but let's get some of the highlights.
It's not that only the ANC is confused, but the whole world is confused, and it's looking at what is going on with horror, I think. There are some parties in Europe which are very pleased, and there are many Americans who are very pleased. There are some people rejoicing about what is going on, even in the Third World, because in their view, the United States has finally shown its real face, and that is not a very pleasant view. Maybe the ANC has really understood that Russia is not what they have been thinking all along, and it is not really at the forefront against imperialism. On the other hand, it may be they just don't know what else to do, because now that they are allies with the main imperialist country, or seem to be an ally of the main imperialist country, then.
What is this new world likely to be for South Africa? Is it going to be a case where, well, you've got to just kowtow to the great powers, or is the price of independence worth it?
Well, South Africa is in a bad spot too, because first of all, it has enjoyed many benefits from the Western countries and from its relations with the United States. And if that is withdrawn, South African economy would suffer. It is really, really in a bad place. Not only South Africa, the whole of Africa will suffer. We already know that the United States has withdrawn its assistance in the medical sphere, for example. There is talk of disallowing the continuation of AGOA, etc., etc. So this will lead to more unemployment and to really, the United States is the second biggest trade partner of South Africa, and this alone is a very, very important factor. But anyway, I don't see, by the way, in terms of trade or anything like that, that Russia or China can easily and quickly substitute what South Africa will lose in terms of its relations with the United States. But it may not even be the worst of it. It is really a world where countries like South Africa have to watch their tongue and to watch their back. Because here in this new multipolar world for which it fought so hard and which it propagated so hard, everybody on its own. Nobody is going to give you anything just for your poverty or for your bad organization or for your for your state capture or anything like that, or for your beautiful eyes. Nobody is going to do that. So, well, we shall see again how it goes. It's early days.
In the world of business banking, the bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
Well, a hefty dose of realism is required. I did mention earlier this week that when I was in London last week at the ARC conference, it seemed to be a beginning of the trend against what we'd seen in the past, where everybody kind of fooled themselves about the idealistic approach, into one where reality is dawning, not least on things like climate change, where the net zero anticipation or propaganda, if you like, has shown to really hurt those countries that were waving the flag. An example was given that Britain, for instance, which makes about 1% of the world's carbon emissions and is on a very strong path at a huge cost. Its energy costs are five times those of competitive countries, that Britain is, doing its bit, whereas China is actually increasing and certainly not paying too much attention to its carbon emissions. It's a heck of a world we're living in right now, and a hefty dose of realism seems to finally be coming in. Well, realism as well on the challenges that South Africa face internally, and in particular on what is going to happen at the next budget or the cabinet members meeting at the moment to try and decide how they're going to put forward a budget on the 12th of March, which is the middle of the BizNews conference. And as a result, we have added a special morning session at 7:30 in the morning, where we will have three experts who will unpack the previous day's budget. That is presuming that the budget actually does go ahead, because that's not a certainty either. The idea was that we, the people, would be paying 2 percentage points more VAT. In other words, the VAT would go from 15% to 17%, and that money would be used to pay civil service staff increases. So we would be paying 2 percentage points more VAT so that the public sector staff could get increases. You just wonder, what happens next year? Do we pay another 2%? And the year thereafter, another 2%? And where does it end? Do we eventually pay 100% VAT? Who knows? But some of the kickback has come from Rob Hersov and from R.W. Johnson, who have been explaining on BizNews' channels that the real problem is not finding money from taxpayers who are already overtaxed, but actually cutting costs. And both of them said a big part of this would be cutting the public sector wage bill. I spoke today to Dr. Erwin Schweller, and he is Professor Emeritus of Public Administration at the University of Stellenbosch and regarded as a legend in this field. Many of the public administrators in South Africa and elsewhere in the world have been taught by him. But he reckons that it's not as simple as everybody is making out. And he provided some reminders that not everyone who works for the state was put there through cadre deployment, although he did say that that was a big factor. Let's listen in.
The whole macroeconomic policy as it relates to public service is also criticized by public servants whom I educated over the years, and they are of all South African backgrounds. And they strive to be professional. So our public service is bloated for political reasons, not for professional public service reasons. And then secondly, the point is there might be 90% of them doing very well professionally. I think that's perhaps a higher margin than I would give to that. Might be 60 or 70% because cadre deployment has been destructive. Let's also say that. And what we've had is a total inflation of senior positions. I mean, we now have, I am told, close to 400 police generals. And we've got similar trends in our National Defence Force, which, by the way, and I agree to some extent with Rob's point, it is a magnificent navy on land, an air force grounded, and an infantry somewhere else. So, but those are political decisions, and they are often also by solid. There is a solid group of public servants looking at professional public service. They're also criticized by them. However, based upon the strong ideological approach of the governing party until the government of national unity, and they had a very deliberate approach to buy off the public servants. And they did that not only by incentivization, by paying them, but you get penalized if you're not loyal. There's often an approach where even professional, well-qualified public servants get left behind because they are not loyal enough. So loyalty has become the qualification, the paramount qualification for promotion in the public service. And under those circumstances, one can forget about any idea of professionalizing the public service, which has been on the agenda for quite some time. So I'm not in any way disagreeing that we have serious work to do with the public service. But I think it is too much of an overgeneralization to then say that then automatically sort of morphs into public service per se is bad. In some ways, destroy the whole system. We should take the best of the traditional approach to professional public service, as is exactly legislated for you in our constitution, and build around that, and work with, you know, solid evidence-based policies. I know we are all emotional, and we should be, because we've had 30 years of disastrous governance. However, what do we do with that? We don't have, our voters don't vote them out. So we'll have them, but now it's starting to break up and we have an opportunity to make a kind of a synthetic approach in terms of taking the bad, combining it with the good, and then progressively improving public service. Because in essence, you're not going to have a government or a state and society or a political system if there's not a public service. So once you have it, make it good. Make the public service great
again. Make the public service great again. I don't know when it last was great, but anyway, it was a little play on Donald Trump. And we did cover that area as well, what the prof thought about the whole Elon Musk, Donald Trump, Doge attack on the U.S. public sector, and indeed whether it would work in South Africa. Well, we close off today's BizNews briefing with further evidence that the swing in the pendulum from left to right, politically, socially, and any other way you want to look at it, has now even reached Silicon Valley. Our partners at the Financial Times had a close look. Here's Mark Filippino, who's the regular host of the FT News briefing.
Silicon Valley used to be a hotbed of liberal activism, but not anymore. Following the re-election of U.S. President Donald Trump, big tech leaders have shifted to the conservative right, and their left-leaning employees aren't exactly protesting. So is this the slow death of Silicon Valley activism? The FT's Hannah Murphy has been looking into it, and she joins me now. Hey, Hannah.
Hey, hi.
One example of this turnaround, Hannah, is Meta's CEO, Mark Zuckerberg. Can you tell me a little bit about his trajectory from liberal ally to Trump supporter?
Sure. As a startup in the 2010s, Silicon Valley companies, including Facebook, now Meta, would attract workers with this promise of a culture of openness and transparency. Staff were told their views mattered and could sort of help shape the company. And Mark Zuckerberg would hold weekly, very open Q&A sessions with staff. They were encouraged to speak out. Zuckerberg also, you know, embraced the more liberal values quite openly. We saw him marching about a decade ago at San Francisco's Gay Pride Parade, waving from a float that had a rainbow flag on the top. This is a very far cry from the Mark Zuckerberg of 2025, which we saw go on the Joe Rogan podcast and call for a more masculine energy in the workplace. And he's also announced these big policy changes, sort of weakening and undoing some hate speech policies, as well as doing away with the fact-checking program. So all in all, a very dramatic reversal from some of those more liberal pushes that we saw in the past.
Yeah, and it was really striking to see him and other tech titans sitting front and center at Trump's inauguration a month ago. So to what extent does Zuckerberg reflect a larger change in Silicon Valley?
You've certainly seen most, if not all, of those tech titans come out and support Trump in a way that they did not do during his previous term. There's a couple of reasons for this. One might be simply that from an idealistic point of view, they are more aligned with conservative values, particularly after you've seen the Biden administration go after the tech companies for areas like competition and antitrust, and perhaps have more testy relationships with some of those companies. It also can be seen as a sort of good business move if you are Meta and Mark Zuckerberg. Donald Trump has previously said that the company was censoring Americans and even threatened to jail Mark Zuckerberg. So obviously he will do everything to try and protect himself and his company from those threats. And I think as well, you've got to consider that perhaps rolling back some of these initiatives like DEI, diversity, equity and inclusion, may be saving the company money. So there's a possible business elements here as well as the ideals side.
Hannah Murphy covers tech for the Financial Times. Thanks, Hannah.
Thanks, Mark.
Well, isn't that interesting? And the world is changing, and changing really, really quickly. Here in South Africa, we have to pay attention. And as Irina Filatova says, just keep your mouth shut. You don't have to make more enemies. It's already a very dangerous world. And as a small little operation, which we are 0.3% of global GDP, less than 0.5% of the world's population, maybe we've overreached in thinking that we're more important than we truly are. We shall see, won't we? I'm Alec Hogg and look forward to the next time. Until tomorrow, cheerio. This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to private banking service now for your business.